Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is Civic Center Commission OKs Plan by John Cruz. Dubuque Civic Center Commission members on Monday supported a new proposal for a smaller renovation of Five Flags Center. In a unanimous vote, commission members approved submitting a letter that expresses their support for the proposed $25.8 million project to make limited renovations to the facility that would address a variety of needs and deficiencies, but would not expand its footprint. That letter will go to City Council members for their work session on Monday, December 5th. Additionally, the letter will specifically suggest that the project feature improvements to the seating at Five Flags and that it ensure that the renovation does not impede a potential future project that would expand the facility. The letter comes after commission members last week offered a mixed response to the new proposal, with some arguing that the renovation did not go far enough in addressing seating shortages and a lack of bathroom accessibility. On Monday, commission members were unified in their opinion that investing $25 million into the facility is a good start. We need to get across that we are 100% in favor of allocating this money to the Five Flags, said commission member Mackenzie Blau. The Civic Center needs it. However, commission members also didn't give up hope of potentially expanding the center after the initial renovations. Several of them expressed support for opening up the north wall of the facility, which connects to West 5th Street to create new outdoor event space that connects with the arena. We could set it up so that the 5th Street wall could be opened up in the future, said Commission Member Brenda Christner. The city's new proposal harkens back to a scenario first presented in 2018 that would replace aging equipment, a leaking roof, and outdated seating, and was estimated at the time to cost $18.6 million, though that price tag likely has climbed since. Additionally, other issues at Five Flags have emerged since then and also need to be addressed. City staff members suggested such a renovation be pursued again, with the bulk of the work being conducted in a two-year period, while another 13 years would be spent making smaller improvements through capital improvement projects. The new scenario was proposed partly because funding it wouldn't require voter approval through a referendum. Instead, the city would utilize $6 million in downtown urban renewal debt capacity already reserved for improvements at Five Flags, along with $18 million in downtown urban renewal debt capacity reserved for building a parking ramp as part of a development agreement with Roshek Property, LLC, Cottingham & Butler, and HTLF. That project is now on hold until parking demand increases in the city. During the meeting on Monday, Commission Member Bryce Parks asked if the city could hold a referendum only asking for an additional $10 million that could be used to complete the North Wall expansion. But City Manager Mike Van Milligan said the project in its entirety would need to be included in the vote, and if it fails to get the needed 60% of votes in favor, then Iowa law would restrict the city from spending the initial $24 million on a smaller renovation. Initially, the proposed letter to the City Council included other suggestions regarding how the money should be spent, including improving movement flow for customers, renovating all restrooms, and improving food service, seating, lighting, and temperature control. However, commission members ultimately chose not to include those suggestions in the letter. Van Milligan stressed that if City Council members decide to move forward with the smaller proposal, then the city is not required to follow the specifications of the scenario presented in 2018. Instead, he suggested that the city would conduct a lengthy process of determining what changes are needed most at Five Flags, a process that would include input from the Civic Center Commission. Let's remember, $24 million is a lot of money, Van Milligan said. This will be a different place when this is over. The next story is from the business column, Infrared Fitness Studio to Offer 24-Hour Access by Kaylee Reese. A new fitness studio using infrared heat plans to open soon in Dubuque. The new franchise location of Hotworks is under construction at 2055 Holiday Drive, Suite 510, which previously housed Signature Health and Fitness. Melissa Noel, general manager of the Hotworks location, said she hopes to open around January 1st. The location was already constructed as a fitness studio, so the build-out part of it has been moving along pretty well, Noel said. It's moving quite fast. We started at the beginning of October on the build-out, and the infrared saunas will be delivered the first week of December. Once people start seeing the saunas getting moved in, it will become more real to them. Noel's sister and brother-in-law, Melina and Marlo Valdebella of St. Louis, are the franchise location's owners. Noel said her sister joined Hotworks in St. Louis about a year ago and started thinking about bringing a location to Dubuque, with Noel running it. All of the fitness sessions will be led via virtual instruction and take place in rooms with infrared saunas, which boosts immunity and allows people to burn more calories in less time, Noel said. The studio will feature 8 rooms. Half of them will be used for activities such as yoga and Pilates, while the other half will include cycling and rowing equipment. While the studio will have staffed hours, the location will be available for use 24 hours per day, Noel said. Those who wish to work out after staffed hours can unlock the studio through an app through which clients also can book a session. We are going to be Dubuque's only 24-hour infrared studio, Noel said. It's geared toward people who are busy and who work odd hours. Every studio in Dubuque has a niche. People work at different paces for different reasons. And we cater to individuals who are busy but want to make fitness a priority. More information on the Dubuque location can be found at hotworks.net/studio, Dubuque, or facebook.com. Appliance store opens in Dyersville. A new appliance store has opened in Dyersville. Appliance Plus opened at 723 9th Street Southeast on November 21st. The store is in the same building as U.S. Cellular, which opened in July and is operated by the same company. We love having the opportunity to grow our locations, and kind of how we got there is because of U.S. Cellular, said J.D. Blue, marketing manager for Appliance Plus and Appliance Plus U.S. Cellular authorized agent. That specific location is large enough to add an appliance store, and we love growing. We kind of took the opportunity and ran with it. The Dyersville Appliance Plus location sells GE appliances, as well as offers delivery and installation services. Appliance Plus is owned by Gary Fox. What eventually became Appliance Plus started in 1946 as an electrical business in Olwine, Iowa, run by Harold Fox, Gary Fox's grandfather. Since Gary Fox took over ownership in 2003, the company has grown to 10 stores selling U.S. Cellular products, and 6 stores selling GE appliances. We're happy for the opportunity with U.S. Cellular and Appliance Plus to be able to be in the Dyersville community, Gary Fox said in an emailed statement. Being a local company in Northeast Iowa, the opportunity to expand into Dyersville area is something we couldn't say no to. Appliance Plus is open from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday. The store can be reached at 563-875-3002. New owners reopened Darlington Pizzeria. Steve and Val Smith now own Vinger's Pizza, 223 Main Street, next to Main Furniture and Home. The Smiths reopened the restaurant at the end of October. The eatery has been closed since June after the previous owners, Ronnie and Michelle Hicks, decided to sell the business. We actually had no intention of buying a pizza business, but Vinger's has always been there, Val Smith said. We're from Darlington and have always lived in Darlington. Bingers has always been the pizza place, and we could not let that not be open. We decided, hey, why not? Life's crazy anyway. Let's do it. Bingers Pizza originally opened in the early 1960s along Wisconsin Highway 81 before later moving to its Main Street location. Val Smith said the Hickses helped her and her husband learn the ropes before they reopened the restaurant. Val Smith also spoke with Rhonda Keitlinger, former restaurant owner and daughter of Helen and James Vinger, who opened Vinger's Pizza, to get the pizza recipe as close to the original Vinger's recipe as possible. The eatery's menu has reverted back to the original Vinger's toppings, such as sausage and pepperoni, as well as a deluxe pizza. Val Smith said the business also makes a garlic cheese stick pizza. Since opening, the restaurant has sold 500 to 600 pizzas in the 4 days it is open each week, she said. We're just really enjoying it, Val Smith said. Our whole family is involved. We've got 4 kids and all the kids have been helping. It's been a big family experience, and it's just kind of nice that the whole family came together to help on it. Vinger's Pizza is open from 4 to 9 p.m. Thursday and Sunday, as well as 4 to 10 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. The restaurant can be reached at 608-776-3760 and found on Facebook. The last story from the front page is titled Developer Scraps Boys Home Near Potosi by Joshua Irvine. Dateline, Potosi, Wisconsin. A proposed boys home for at-risk youth will seek a new location, ending an 18-month effort to establish it near Potosi. Florida attorney Joel Hirschhorn said he is set to close on Wednesday, November 30th, on the sale of a 50-acre property in Grant County that would have served as the site of Adams Place, a planned group home for youth from violent neighborhoods in Chicago and Milwaukee. Hirschhorn already completed the sale of a contiguous 19-acre lot. At Adams Place, the initial 8 boys would have lived and tended to farm animals and gardens while attending school in the Potosi School District. Hirschhorn characterized the home as offering a fresh start on life. Adams Place is a nonprofit organization named after 13-year-old Adam Toledo, who was fatally shot by Chicago police officers in March 2021 and whose killing spurred protests and calls for reform to the Chicago Police Department's foot pursuit policies. Hirschhorn is representing the Toledo family in an ongoing lawsuit against the city of Chicago and Eric Stillman, the officer who fatally shot the boy. But Grant County residents pushed back against the project in a pair of town hall meetings hosted in August 2021 and July 2022, raising concerns about the logistics of the project and already strained local schools and social services, while also making charged remarks about safety concerns posed by the would-be residents. Hirschhorn took umbrage with the latter, characterizing the community response as xenophobic, and said the July 2022 meeting featured the worst professional treatment he had been subject to in his legal career. He said his decision to sell the land came down to his belief that any youth in the program would be subject to poor treatment by local residents. I couldn't bring him into that community where he'd be hated and instantly blamed for everything, Hirschhorn said. Potosi School District Superintendent Kurt Cohen said Monday that plans for the home were plagued by misinformation and rumors and spoke positively about Hirschhorn's work with the school district, but believed the plan's failure came down to strained public services and unanswered questions about the home. He said the school district would have accepted the boys with open arms. Hirschhorn also spoke positively about his interaction with the school district. School board president Kurt McMahon also said Hirschhorn failed to address the community's concerns sufficiently. He also took issue with the comments Hirschhorn made to the Grant County Herald Independent when the newspaper announced Hirschhorn's plans to sell the land. Hirschhorn said he expected the boys to be treated as pariahs. In the community meetings we held, there was some pushback from the community, but I don't think this was the backlash he complained about, McMahon said. I haven't appreciated his painting our community in such a negative way. Hirshhorn said he is seeking another site for Adams Place. For his part, he conceded he should have better researched Potosi and Grant County before purchasing the land. I guess I let my Wisconsin law school liberal days interfere with my judgment, Hirshhorn said. Sheriff Nate Dreckman was among the community members who had raised questions of security concerns regarding the home's underage occupants, though he said Monday that he never opposed the plan. Dreckman said he would have had security concerns with residents who were on the verge of entering the criminal justice system, but also had questions about the boys' safety. There was some opposition throughout the whole deal. So is there going to be security on the premises if community members who are upset show up at the property? Dreckman asked. It's both ways. Also on the front page is a big aerial picture of a roundabout, and it shows a semi-tractor trailer maneuvers on a roundabout now open on South John Deere Road at its intersection with Peru Road on Monday. Turning to page 2, the first article is Parker Project Moving Forward by Elizabeth Kelsey, Dateline Galena, Illinois. A major resort project in Galena on Monday night received final approval for an amendment and expansion. City Council members voted 5-1 to approve the second reading of an ordinance authorizing the execution of an amendment to the annexation agreement for the Parker, a planned commercial development located on a property including Galena Marine Hospital. Council members also voted 5-1 to approve the first reading and waive the second reading of two ordinances annexing 18.2 additional acres of the Parker development into city limits and amending the city's zoning map to include that property as a planned unit development. For all three ordinances, Council Member Pam Bernstein cast the dissenting vote. Council Member Katie Winan was absent. No council members spoke about the project or their reasons for casting their votes during the meeting. The Parker Project is spearheaded by developer True North Quality Homes, LLC, and sister company BNV, which plan to restore the Marine Hospital and build more than 100 cottages around it, along with a cafe building, a restaurant, and event space, outdoor dining areas, vineyards, and walking trails. Original project plans were approved by the City Council earlier this year and span nearly 80 acres. However, council members 2 weeks ago approved a zoning amendment adding 18 acres on the west side of the property. A new entrance, reworked roadways, and expanded walking trails and vineyards. After Monday's meeting, BNV President Sandra Lawrence and project architect Jim Baranski said developers now will begin preparing final designs for the next phase of the project. Project documents state that the phase includes complete rehabilitation of the Marine Hospital, construction of 28 cottages, and development of roads, parking spaces, and walking trails, along with the planting of 5 acres of vineyard and construction of the winery. Lawrence said Parker Project officials hope to bring finalized plans for that phase to the city's Zoning Board of Appeals for approval in about 3 to 4 months. We're hoping that we go to the zoning committee and get a positive approval to move forward, she said, later adding, we're optimistic that we'll be able to start building next summer. The first phase of the four-phase project involved the planting of about 2,500 grapevines for the vineyard, which took place in June. Each phase must be approved by the city's zoning board before construction can begin. City residents have raised numerous concerns about the Parker project, including that it will place increased traffic demands on nearby roads and increase the risk of crashes in an already dangerous area. Safety is a problem at the intersection of 4th Street and U.S. Highway 20. Traffic volume is over capacity, said Galena resident James Boho at Monday's meeting. Any additional traffic at the volume of the Parker project will exacerbate those issues. Lawrence said developers will continue to listen to and try to address any concerns raised by residents as the approval process continues. The next story is Workshop to Focus on Agricultural Grassland by Eric Hogstrom, Dateline Elizabeth, Illinois. A local workshop next month will highlight the importance of introducing cover crops in the form of grassland into agricultural operations. There is clear data that suggests the need for more perennial ground cover. Among the reasons are soil health, water quality, and habitat, said Laura Payne, Outreach Coordinator for Grassland 2.0, a regional effort led by University of Wisconsin that promotes environmentally friendly grassland-based agriculture practices. Soil health has become very important to many farmers. Payne is among the scheduled presenters at Working Towards Regenerative Agriculture, a workshop set for December 9th in Elizabeth. The workshop is being held by the Extension Services of University of Illinois and University of Wisconsin with Grassland 2.0. The workshop is open to everyone, not just producers, said John Strausser, a Wisconsin Extension grassland and perennial agriculture outreach specialist who has done extensive research on farming practices in Grant County, Wisconsin, and Joe Davies County, Illinois. Farmers see soil erosion and they want to be part of the solution, Strausser said. This workshop isn't really about why we have to reintroduce perennial crops. This is about how. Payne will discuss how rotational grazing of livestock on farms can provide perennial grasslands. One of the themes we're focusing on is how we can reintroduce livestock in places where they don't always have a culture of raising livestock, she said. Grasslands also can help boost bird habitats. Wildlife studies have noted declines in Midwestern grassland songbirds, such as meadowlarks, and found the decrease in birds corresponds with reductions in grazing and hay fields. Grassland birds have become one of the most endangered species in North America, Payne said. The prairies were their habitat. They need the structure of grass and grasslands to support their nests and the insects they eat. Payne said well-managed pastureland has been shown to provide a substitute for the birds' historic habitat. Pastures can make a big difference, she said. Turning to the News in Brief column, authorities ID 2 killed in PDC crash that closed highway for hours. Dateline Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Authorities on Monday released the names of 2 people killed in a head-on crash Sunday in the Prairie du Chien area. 3 other people were injured. Tracy Jo Larson, 43, of Prairie du Chien, and Luke Hackman, 36, of Decorah, Iowa, died in the wreck, according to the Crawford County Sheriff's Department. The crash occurred at about 11:20 a.m. Sunday on U.S. Highway 18 between the bridges of Prairie du Chien and Marquette, Iowa. A press release states that Larson was eastbound on the highway while Hackman was westbound. The 2 vehicles collided head-on. Hackman's vehicle also had 1 adult and 2 child passengers who suffered non-life-threatening injuries, according to the release. Their names have not been released. The crash closed the highway for about 4.5 hours. The incident remains under investigation. The release states that 19 emergency entities responded to the crash, including the Wisconsin State Patrol and Iowa Department of Transportation. Convicted felon on work release fails to return to Dubuque facility. Authorities said a convicted felon on work release failed to return to the state correctional facility at 1494 Elm Street in Dubuque on Sunday. Christopher Blackman, Jr., 27, was convicted of second-degree robbery in Scott County, according to the Iowa Department of Corrections. A press release states that Blackman is 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighs 256 pounds. He was admitted to the Dubuque work release facility on September 15th. Anyone with information on Blackman's location should call Dubuque Police at 563-589-4415. And Harlem Globetrotters returning to Dubuque. An exhibition basketball team famed for its members' flashy skills will return to Dubuque in the spring. The Harlem Globetrotters will take the court at 7 p.m. Monday, March 20th, at Dubuque's Five Flags Center, the venue announced Monday morning. Tickets range from $20 to $80 and will go on sale at 10 a.m. Monday, December 5th at the Five Flags box office and Ticketmaster.com. Turning to the opinion page, we have a letter from the editor. Telegraph Herald to change policy regarding naming victims by Amy Gilligan, the Telegraph Herald executive editor. After several weeks of discussions, we've decided to make a policy change in the way we report some criminal activity in the Telegraph Herald, and I wanted to let readers know about the change. Beginning today, we will no longer report the names of victims in certain assault and theft cases. Making such a change is complicated and required a fair amount of discussion on various types of charges and circumstances we encounter, and how we would handle each to remain consistent. We try diligently to adhere to guidelines so that similar incidents get similar treatment in news coverage. The biggest change readers will see will be in what we call the police blotter, which runs daily on page 2A. A list of bulleted items describing police activity from the daily law enforcement reports that we check. Typically, in a case with domestic assault, for example, the blotter lists the name and identifying information of the person arrested and the charges that the person faces. The next sentence lists the person who was subjected to the assault. After this change, the second sentence will no longer be there. In some cases, in which the charges approach a higher threshold, such as attempted murder or when there is a weapon involved, we believe those incidents pose an increased community concern, and they often run not in the blotter but as small stories in the paper. In those incidents, we will continue to report victims' names. This isn't the first time that we've discussed how we handle the names of victims in these delicate situations. I was part of a similar discussion some 20 years ago in which we met with law enforcement officials, an assistant county attorney, and victims' advocates to determine the best practices. At that time, we agreed that running the names in all cases made sense for a couple of reasons. People have a right to know what kind of criminal activity is happening in their neighborhood and who is involved. And advocates at that time felt that there was some benefit in making people aware of who the victims were. After all, there is no shame in being the victim, and perhaps friends and neighbors could reach out to help them. We also agreed that if a case arose with special circumstances in which the police felt our running the name of a victim would expose the person to further danger, they could reach out to us about it, and we would defer to their request. That rarely happens, but we have honored that agreement over the years. Today's world looks a lot different than it did 20 years ago. Some of the requests we've had for a change in policy came about because of a significant increase of crimes against people in the workplace. Emergency room nurses and doctors, teachers, law enforcement. Often those folks who have encountered violence in the workplace would prefer not to have their names publicized, and we think that makes sense for us going forward. Similarly, we will eliminate naming victims in some theft cases, which can lead to further victimization. All the information remains a public record and available to anyone who goes searching for it. But for our part, we are choosing not to put the names out there in some circumstances. We live in an era in which news articles remain just a Google search away, even years later, and people's personal information is easier to find than it was years ago. Remember when an unlisted phone number granted you anonymity? We can't automatically, retroactively eliminate every victim's name from past stories with this change. But if someone requests that their name be removed from a past article and it fits under our new guidelines for withholding names, we will remove it. To make such a request, go to telegraphherald.com/removeme and fill out the form. If you have questions about the new policy, please drop me a note. Also, don't forget to get your First Citizen nomination sent in before December 1st deadline. Nominations for First Citizen can be submitted at telegraphherald.com/First Citizen or mailed or dropped off to me at the Telegraph Herald through Thursday, December 1st. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Shirley G. McLaughlin, Shirley Grace Ganahl McLaughlin, 89 of Dubuque, died Saturday, November 26, 2022, at home with her family by her side. A rosary service will be held at 3 p.m. Wednesday, November 30th, 2022, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, followed by visitation until a 7 p.m. prayer service. The Mass of Christian Burial for Shirley will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 1st, 2022, at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, with Father Brian Dellert as the celebrant. Entombment will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Herbert J. Lang, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Herbert Joseph Herbie Lang, 85, of Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque, formerly of rural Hazel Green, Wisconsin, passed away on Saturday, November 26, 2022, at Stonehill Care Center. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 1st, 2022, at the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Keeler, Wisconsin, with the Father Bernard Rott officiating. Burial will follow in the church cemetery. Visitation is from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, Illinois, and from 10 to 10:45 a.m. on Thursday at the Immaculate Conception Parish Center in Keeler. There will be a parish rosary at 3:45 p.m. on Wednesday at the funeral home. Betty L. Young. Betty L. Young, 73, of Dubuque, died on Friday, November 25, 2022. Private burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family. Gary F. Clower. Gary Frederick Clower, 81, passed away at Luther Manor Nursing Home on Friday, November 25th, after a courageous battle with Parkinson's disease. Visitation will be from 4 until 7 p.m. Thursday, December 1st, 2022, at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. A prayer service will be at 7 p.m. The Mass of Christian Burial for Gary will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 2nd, 2022, at Church of the Resurrection with Father Phil Gibbs as the celebrant. Military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post No. 6 and the Iowa Army National Guard. Cecilia Davis, Cincinnati, Wisconsin. Sister Cecilia Elian Davis, O.P., died at St. Dominic Villa on November 17, 2022. Casey McNett is handling the arrangement. Her services will be at Cincinnati, November 30th and December 1st. Nancy Fleming, McGregor, Iowa. Nancy Fleming, 93, of McGregor, died on Monday, November 21st, 2022. Private services and burial will be held at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Lancaster, Wisconsin. Michael L. Schutte, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. Michael L. Schutte, 75, of Hazel Green, Wisconsin, passed away on Sunday, November 27th, 2022. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, November 30th, at Howdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, Wisconsin, with Pastor Gus Barnes officiating. Burial will be held at a later date. Family and friends may call on Wednesday, November 30th, from 9 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. The Howdenshield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City, Wisconsin, is serving the family. Charlie M. Eggleston, Manchester, Iowa. Charlene Marie Eggleton, 13, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, November 23, 2022, at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. She was born on June 6, 2009, in Manchester, Iowa, the daughter of Thomas and Jennifer Rucker Eggleton. Charlie was raised in the Manchester area and was an eighth grade student at West Delaware Middle School in Manchester. Online condolences may be sent to leonardmullerfh.com. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, December 1st, 2022, at St. Mark Catholic Church in Englewood, Iowa, with the Reverend John Hagen presiding. Visitation 2 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, November 30th, 2022 at St. Mark Catholic Church in Edgewood, Iowa, with a prayer service at 7 p.m. Interment at Sandy Creek Cemetery, rural Manchester, Iowa. Pamela K. Ahrensdorf. Pamela K. Ahrensdorf, 70, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, November 27th, 2022. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 30th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, December 3rd, at the funeral home. Joanne F. Ishman, Elkader, Iowa. Joanne F. Ishman, 91, of Elkader, died Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 2nd at Leonard Funeral Home in Elkader and from noon to 1 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd at Bethany Lutheran Church in Elkader, where services will follow. Interment will be in Eastside Cemetery in Elkader. Edith A. McIntyre, Savannah, Illinois. Edith A. McIntyre, 91, of Savannah, died on Friday, November 25th, 2022. Visitation will be held from noon to 2 p.m. today at Savannah Presbyterian Church, where services will follow. Burial will be in Lost Mound Cemetery in Hanover. Laud Jones Funeral Home of Savannah is assisting the family. Catherine Potter, Deerfield, Illinois. Catherine Katie Potter, 89, of Deerfield and formerly of Hanover, died on Tuesday, November 22, 2022. Graveside services will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at Evergreen Cemetery in Hanover. Law Jones Funeral Home of Hanover is assisting the family. Lila M. Jarrett, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Lila M. Jarrett, 100, of Lancaster, died on Friday, November 25th, 2022. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, December 2nd, at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster, where services will follow. Burial will be in Hillside Cemetery. Funeral Services. Donald J. Davis, Sherrill, Iowa, Celebration of Life, 2 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 6th, Bright Box Country Dining, 563 Balltown Road, Sherrill. Doris Donovan, Dubuque. Visitation 9 to 11:15 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th, Church of the Resurrection, Mass of Christian Burial, 11:30 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Bernice Knippel, Dyersville, Iowa. Visitation after 9 a.m. today, Rife Funeral Home, Dyersville. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, St. Francis Basilica Catholic Church, Dyersville. Everly K. Cryer, Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, Church of the Resurrection. Rose C. Oldenburg, Galena, Illinois. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. with a parish rosary service at 3:30 p.m. Wednesday. 3:30 p.m. Friday, December 2nd, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. And from 10:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Galena. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Margie J. Roth, East Dubuque, Illinois. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. with parish prayer service at 3:30 p.m. today and from 9 to 9:45 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th. Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, St. Mary's Catholic Church, East Dubuque. And Jason C. Sturdivant, Savannah, Illinois. Visitation, noon to 1 p.m. today, Law Jones Funeral Home, Savannah. Service, 1 p.m. today, at the funeral home. Celebration of life following services today, Manny's in Savannah. Now turning to the sports page, the headline is Ushering in a New Era. Girls Prep Wrestling, Western Dubuque Scramble, by Danny Miller. Dateline Epworth, Iowa. Tom Danner has seen just about everything in the world of wrestling. He had never seen anything like this until Monday night. The longtime local wrestling fixture won a state title at Dubuque Waller in 1971, qualified for the national tournament as a collegiate at Northwest Missouri State, and guided the Western Dubuque boys to the school's first ever state dual meet in 2008. Now, at the helm of the Bobcat Girls program, Danner put another checkmark on the list. "It's a whole different atmosphere in this gym tonight," Danner said after the Bobcats hosted the Western Dubuque Girls Scramble, the first ever girls wrestling tournament in Dubuque County, sanctioned as a varsity sport by the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. "The girls are so supportive of each other. It's incredible. The energy, the enthusiasm, it's what the sport needs and appreciates." This season marks the first time in history that the IGHSAU is recognizing girls wrestling as a sanctioned varsity sport. Roughly 80 girls from Western Dubuque, Dubuque Senior, Dubuque Hempstead, Dubuque Wallert, and Cascade grappled officially for the first time in their home county in an all-girl event. Previously, female wrestlers were linked in with the boys' program, but had the opportunity to participate in a non-sanctioned state tournament sponsored by the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and the Officials Association. Dubuque senior 12th grader Hannah Riel placed fifth at the IWCOA state event last year and remembers just a couple of years ago when she could count her fellow female grapplers on one hand. Now she's part of a team of 30-plus Rams. "First, I started off with just myself, and then it slowly grew to six people, and then to a whole team," said Riel, who went 2-0 on the night with two pins. "It should be like this with every sport. Girls run it, so we might as well be part of a sanctioned sport. It's just great to see this growth. It's a sense of empowerment, too." Hempstead senior Kendra Rohner decided to give wrestling a try after a little bit of peer pressure coaxed her to go out for the team. After just her second ever meet on Monday, she wished she would have pulled the trigger earlier. "I'm just having a lot of fun," said Rohner, who won twice by fall. "I never knew I had this competitiveness in me. I play other sports, but nothing compares to this. The thrill of the rush, it's all on you. You're the only one out there." In her third season, Wallert senior Avery Schmidt was inspired to give the sport a try after her sister, Alana, became the first IWCOA girls state champion from Dubuque in 2020. "I didn't even know girls wrestling was a thing. Then I went to my sister's state tournament and I just loved it," Schmidt said. "The energy in this sport is way higher than it's ever been, so that's just a really cool thing." Schmidt's teammate, Bailey Wheelu, said a state tournament run in softball has her in just the right mentality to compete in wrestling. "It makes you feel unstoppable because everyone thought it was impossible," Wheelu said. "In this sport, you have to have confidence because if the other person smells your fear or sees it, you're done. The unstoppable mentality is what I went out there with tonight." Cascade coach Josh Lawler's team is a mix of first-time wrestlers and upperclassmen, but no matter the skill level, his girls are enjoying every minute of it. "They're just loving it," Lawler said. "The independence, the sportsmanship, the energy is just awesome. These girls are beating the heck out of each other, but then go out and pick the other one up, and they all get better with every match." In United States Hockey League, Dubuque Fighting Saints, "Burchill Commits to Wolverines" by Jim Leitner. Mikey Burchill understands the amount of work ahead of him in his path to collegiate hockey, and now he will have a maize and blue carrot dangling in front of him. The 5'10", 154-pound left wing from Mundelein, Illinois, committed to the University of Michigan hockey program on Thanksgiving Day. He will spend one more full season in Dubuque and join the Wolverines in the fall of 2024. "It's an unbelievable opportunity," Burchill said on Saturday night. "Once the opportunity presented itself, it would have been extremely hard to turn it down. That place just feels like home. I know I have to grow in pretty much every aspect of my game, the defensive side of the game for sure, but it definitely will motivate me even more knowing that I'm going to Michigan. I have some expectations to live up to now, and I want to be able to contribute when I get there eventually." Burchill, 17, has enjoyed a breakthrough season while playing on Dubuque's top line with center Owen Michaels and the team's leading scorer, former Northeastern University forward Ryan St. Louis. Burchill shares the team lead with 7 goals and shares second place on the team's scoring chart with 15 points in helping the Saints go 9, 41, and 1 for a .667 winning percentage, tied for fourth best in the 16-team USHL. A year ago, while playing significantly fewer minutes, Burchill contributed 11 goals, 19 points, and a +8 rating as a 16-year-old rookie on a veteran-dominant team that went 40, 16, 3, and 3. Burch can skate. He can make plays offensively, and you can tell by the way he carries himself that he has that confidence level of having a year of experience in the league, Saints coach Kirk McDonald said. But, just as importantly, he's learned how to play when he doesn't have the puck, which is really important when you get to the next level, and hopefully for Burch, the level after that. The exciting thing about him is you know there's so much more in him. Don't get me wrong, he's playing great, and he's on pace for 60-some points, which is tremendous in this league. But with his work ethic, you know he'll keep putting in the work, get stronger, work on his skill stuff, and the overall growth of his game. The sky's the limit for him. Burchill committed to the Wolverines at a time of a little uncertainty, despite a number 5 national ranking. Brandon Nerado has served as the interim head coach since this summer when the school parted ways with Mel Pearson. I've crossed that question a lot, but I know Coach Nerado really well, and I've known him for years, said Burchill, who played for the Detroit-based CompuWare AAA program prior to being selected 5th overall in the 2021 USHL Futures Draft. I know most of the coaching staff, too, so I'm not worried about it. I'd love for Coach Nerado to get the job permanently, but you know Michigan is one of those programs that will always have a great coaching staff. During his visit, Burchill spent time with former Saints forward Jackson Hallam, a Michigan freshman and Vegas Golden Knights prospect. I actually got pretty close to Jackson at the end of last season, Burchill said. He's been a really good mentor for me, and he's helped me through a lot. I'm fortunate because I've had a lot of great vets here in Dubuque. I love it here, and Dubuque has been so important in everything that's come my way. I couldn't be happier. McDonald considers Burchill as the leader of the young guys on the Saints roster, including first-year players James Reeder, Gavin Cornforth, Noah Powell, and Lucas St. Louis. But Burchill began to show that side of himself at the end of last season, when he asked President of Hockey Operations and General Manager Callie Larson for the phone numbers of the Saints draft picks to welcome them to the team. Leadership is a skill you have to learn over time, too, and he's getting better at that. A lot of it comes with playing on the top line and being aware of how you have to carry yourself, McDonald said. Even though he's just in an 05 birth year, he has that experience in the league that he can pass along to the younger guys when they're hanging out together in school or study hall. He knows you have to be dialed in all the time, and that translates to the games. It's a credit to him. Turning to the lifestyle page, the top article is After 20 Years, Giving the Readers the Last Word by Catherine Fisher. Culminating this series of columns celebrating 20 years as a Telegraph Herald columnist, I hand over the page to you, dear readers. Your responses have ranged from touching to hilarious to corrective to absolutely funereal. Des Moines Register writer Donald Call once commented that his column was titled Over the Coffee because it gave readers permission to use his articles as a blotter for their spilled java. French novelist Daniel Pinac created a Reader's Bill of Rights, which includes the right to not read and the right to skip pages. Considering responses from readers of my columns through the years, I would add the right to disagree and the right to take topics a lot further. Formerly writing for national publications, I almost never heard directly from readers. Within months of my earliest Telegraph Herald columns, however, I was stopped outside the library by a man asking, "Aren't you that writer lady from the Telegraph Herald?" There's nothing like a local newspaper. Frequently, you respond to Christmas columns. One year, I decried oddball Christmas gifts like Weight Watchers membership, the Ungame, and the anatomically correct Baby Tenderlove male doll turned into a squirter by our son. I also owned up to my inner Scrooge, declaring holidays ruined by shopping and decorating too early, before Halloween. Worse, I labeled Milwaukee legend Billy the Brownie the ultimate narc to Santa. A week later, I found a note from Woody, a neighbor who passed my house on his way home each day from his job at the Telegraph Herald. "Are you the same person who used to leave your wreath on the front door till Easter? Overcompensation?" The wreath was down by Groundhog Day that year. But reader Charlene became misty-eyed about my portrayal of Billy the Brownie and emailed a photo of her Billy the Brownie ornament with a note. "Thank you for renewing my memories of Christmas." Originally, my writing was used by readers upon the death of loved ones. During Anissa's funeral, one of her family read from my column about her. When piano teacher Mr. Ferber passed on, his wife told me she'd put my column alongside him in the casket. The poor man, as if those years he had to tolerate my piano playing weren't bad enough. Among the most touching reader mail followed the columns about the deaths of my brothers, Mom Tweedy and my sis-in-law, Dora, on 9/11. "I lost a brother, too. Hang in there." "Because of reading your column, I feel as if I knew your brother, Chris. I just read your thoughtful 9/11 writing. It was very emotional, since we all have memories of where we were when we heard or saw this nation's tragedy. Carol." Occasionally, columns were carried into community affairs. A column about my niece was used at a Milwaukee Center for People with Down Syndrome and Mental Disabilities. Another reader quoted from my column at a Dubuque Community School District board meeting about delaying high school morning startup time by a few hours. I suspect most readers think, "That Fisher, what does she know anyway?" Carol Finsel responded to my failed farmer column by attempting to teach me the habits of vegetables and plants. I never did catch on. Family has suffered the worst of it. Upon reading several of my columns, our son replied, "It didn't happen that way, Mom." I reminded him that I hold the pen. Mom Tweedy started interrupting our conversations with, "But you can't write about this for the newspaper." And then she'd chuckle, "Oh, go ahead, who cares?" Just when I think Rotten Tomatoes are headed my way, readers surprise me. I once encouraged people to use their cloth bags instead of accumulating yet more plastic, which results in GPOP, the Great Pacific Ocean Patch, a veritable floating island of plastic bags and bottles, discarded Legos, rubber tires, computer monitors, and more, which infiltrate fish, birds, and other wildlife, some of which ends up on our dinner plates. Dozens of email responses poured in. "I have been showing the Bagot movie to the community for a year now and have reached about 2,000 people. To make a difference, we need to come from many angles, so I appreciate your article and would like to join you in the Unbagged Lady Lunch Club." Bev, "We have a multitude of reusable bags, but always seem to forget them. Still, we carry our purchases home naked, as you called it. I enjoyed the article and hope more citizens of Dubuque will go bagless." Stephen, "I am going to use fabric that I have been storing for years to gift wrap all family presents from now on. Thank you for the inspiration." Judy, "Among my favorites are your humorous remarks when I write about the English language, wayward spelling, British versus American terms, slang and the like. Inevitably, my inbox fills with corrections." One reader, whom I've come to call the professor, sends along the etymology of Anglo-Saxon and Germanic roots. I've never met him face to face, but I feel as if I could pick him out of a crowd. After writing about how many men are incapable of skipping correctly, the next day's voicemail greeted me with, "Hi, Katie, this is Bernie over at the high school," he said, laughing out of control. "I just want you to know that a bunch of us coaches tried skipping in the hall. And you're right, we can't. This past summer, as I was about to undergo a medical procedure, masked and in a medical gown, I looked up groggily at the nurse who was checking my birthday, etc., and even in my near-sedated state, I heard her say, 'Aren't you Catherine Fisher who writes for the Telegraph Herald?' The procedure? A colonoscopy. Something about my columns must have resonated. Thanks to all of you, dear readers. Thanks for the laughs, the insights, and mostly for sticking with columns like this to the end. Without you, I'd be out of a job. And that does it for today's reading of the Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.